From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is KCRW's program of stories and original documentaries. It's part of KCRW's independent producer project, kind of a laboratory for independent radio producers, writers, and performers. And today on the program, a story from scientist and storyteller Moran Cerf.
And at first it was very subtle. It says, scientists say that they can record dreams. 10 minutes later, it was, scientists have been recording dreams for the last decade. A minute later, it was, scientists are recording dreams and keeping them in database. They have all our dreams in database. 20 minutes later, the FBI uses scientists to record everyone's dreams. There's no mention of my real work. All that you can see on all the reports of all the news, MSNBC, BBC, CNN, all of them talking about the scientists at Caltech who can record your dreams.
What if you're a scientist and you create something so incredible, so revolutionary, that you may be standing on the verge of scientific greatness as you present your findings to the world? But then the world just gets it wrong. It's a program about perceptions and misperceptions, both personal and worldwide. The storyteller is Moran Cerf. This is a guy who seems more like a movie character than an actual person. He's originally from Israel, but nowadays he lives in Los Angeles, doing high-level scientific research as a postdoctoral research fellow at Caltech and UCLA. But that's his day job. By night, you may have heard him tell stories at the Moth storytelling competitions here in Los Angeles. He's also been heard on the nationally syndicated Moth Radio Hour.
It's a hobby. I also speak very fast. I always thought that with my accent and speaking very fast, no one's going to ever be able to understand me, although I could fit any story in 5 minutes. I can take, Ulysses and fit it in 5 minutes, if need be, with my speed.
The first time he told a story at the Moth, he won. And he's won several times since then. And in 2010, he won the Moth Grand Slam, sort of the national championship of storytelling. And now, if you search Moran Cerf online, you'll find half the links are about his scientific work and half his storytelling.
I became addicted, I think, to it when I started walking in the streets and talking to myself about myself in third person and saying, Moran walks on the street now, he has this crossroad and he can go left or right. And I started like telling my story as I was acting it. And I realized not only am I living this story right now, but I'm seeing stories everywhere, but I also make stories where they're not necessary. For instance, if I go and there's a fork and I can go either on the safe road on the left, where there's light and everything's okay, or into the dark alley on the right where everything says danger and don't go there, I would always go to the right so I could have a story when I come out.
And believe me, he's got a lot of material for stories. I mentioned a few minutes ago that he's like a movie character. Just listen to him describe the path he took to become a scientist. It turns out back in Israel, Moran was a professional hacker, one of those guys who's paid to break into banks and other sensitive areas to test their security. This kind of thing exists in real life. Maybe you're as surprised as I was.
I was working as a hacker in Israel and all over the world, and this was my job. I never thought I'm going to do anything else but hacking. And I had a very stable life. I had a girlfriend of many years. Everything was perfect. But my girlfriend was a little bit older than me. So when I was 27, she was 34, and she wanted to have kids. She said, either we're going to have kids now, or we need to break up because I need to do that quickly. I can't wait. Around the same time, a guy came to Israel to give a talk. The moment that changed everything was the moment that Francis Crick, who was in his late 80s, came to Israel to give a talk. He was a very well-respected scientist in a field I didn't know much about, neuroscience. But prior to that, he was the guy responsible for discovering DNA. Watson and Crick were the guys who discovered DNA and published in Nature their work in 1953, where they explained how DNA works. Before that, Francis Crick, with a large team, were hackers. People whose job was to use math and all kinds of techniques to break codes. So Francis Crick and his team broke codes in the 1940s, ended up in the 1950s becoming very well-known scientists. Some of them were the ones who built the atomic bomb. Some of them were the guys who invented the computer for the first time. And Francis Crick himself, he was the guy who was involved in discovering the DNA and explaining how DNA works in genetics. So in his mind, hackers who are good in hacking computers make for great scientists. So when he was in Israel, there was a dinner which I attended and had a chat with him, and he learned about my career as a hacker. So he was very fascinated by my stories of breaking into banks and breaking into all kinds of institutions. And he said, oh my God, you're the next generation. You guys are the hackers of the 1990s. You should all go into science. And he basically proposed to me to consider changing my career from hacker to neuroscientist. Because in his mind, if you can break codes, you can also break the brain, which is in a way a bunch of codes that interact with each other. So if you make for a good hacker, you can make a good neuroscientist. A month later, my girlfriend broke up with me, and suddenly I wanted to be as far as possible from Israel. I looked at the globe and Los Angeles seemed far enough, and I said, that's where I want to go. I don't want to be here to see my ex-girlfriend getting married, having kids with someone else. I don't want to be exposed to it. I want to be as far as possible. And I called and I said, can I come and work here? He was by then retired, but he recommended someone else, who was a professor at Caltech, who he said is a great scientist, a guy he was mentoring at the time. He said, why don't you go work with this guy? That's going to be a great way to get into neuroscience. January 1st, 2005, I flew to the US and offered to basically help in a science project here at Caltech. After a while, I got interested and applied to Caltech, and within 7 months, I became a scientist.
Today on Unfictional, Moran Cerf tells a story about what can go wrong when you present a big scientific discovery to the world.
And the particular work I do has to do with looking at people's brains from the inside. We perform a surgery on those people, and then we put electrodes deep inside their brain and try to see how the brain functions from within.
I was always interested in understanding how one thing wins our attention compared to others. So you can think of walking in the street, and there are many things that you see. There's sounds, there's smells, and somehow only one thing penetrates your consciousness and you become aware of. Like, if you walk on the street, your eyes see everything. They see trees and they see cars and they see houses, but somehow...
This is from a video that Moran Cerf and his colleagues produced to explain what their project was all about. The idea was to present it in clear, easy-to-understand language. Unfortunately, it was this very video that ended up being the thing that confused the world about just what these scientists had done.
Our work had to do with understanding how people think.
This is UCLA neurosurgeon Itzhak Fried, a colleague of Moran Cerf's.
This particular study was done in a group of neurosurgical patients undergoing brain surgery for severe intractable epilepsy that cannot be treated successfully with medications. And the key challenge in this patient is to identify an area in the brain where potentially the seizures are coming from.
This type of epilepsy has a particular place where it originates, and then the seizure spreads from this location all over the brain. If you're able to pinpoint the exact location of the epilepsy, of the seizure's onset, and take it out, you're able to cure the patient from the epilepsy. You can walk away seizure-free. So all you have to do is somehow find the onset of epilepsy in people's brain. How do you do that? Well, in a particular group I collaborate with at UCLA, there's a neurosurgeon whose job is to open patients' brains, implant electrodes deep inside their brain in the area where we think the epilepsy onset is, and then have the patient sit there in bed with electrodes in their brain for a few days, waiting to have seizures. The patient sits there, the electrodes record the activity in his brain while he waits to have a seizure, and when he eventually has a seizure, we can look using those electrodes at the flow of the seizure, how it starts in one point, moves to the other point, trajectories to the other point, and so on, and you can understand how the spread of seizures is happening in the brain.
But the project that received worldwide attention for Moran Cerf and his colleagues at Caltech and UCLA, the project that this story is about, was not exactly about epilepsy, but the scientists were able to take advantage of the fact that while these epilepsy patients were sitting around waiting for a seizure to strike, and they just happened to have electrodes in their brain tracking their neurons, maybe there was something else they could do with their time.
This guy sits in bed for 10 days, watching TV, reading books. He can't do much because his brain is connected to a machine with wires inside his brain. So he has to stay in bed and just wait to have seizures. He doesn't do much and is usually happy to also help science. So we ask him, if you're already here, we already have electrodes in your brain, would you mind participating in studies where we're going to show you images, have you remember things and think of things? And as you do that, we can look in your brain and see how the brain works when you do those things. We can see, for instance, how your brain looks when you think of your mother.
Please call
how your brain looks when you read a book, how your brain looks when you feel something, and you can understand how human brains work from the inside. This allowed us to actually conduct this very unique study where we had people sit in bed, think of all kinds of things, the Eiffel Tower, Marilyn Monroe, their mother, places they like, and as we look at their brain, we could see how the thought manifests itself in the brain, and we showed on the screen their thoughts. So the patient would think of the Eiffel Tower, he would look in the brain and see how the brain kind of creates this thought of Eiffel Tower in the brain, and we would show a picture of the Eiffel Tower on the screen. The patient would think of Marilyn Monroe, we would see how the brain looks when he thinks of Marilyn Monroe, understand that that's what he's thinking of, and show a picture of Marilyn Monroe. So we would basically project his thoughts to a computer screen in front of his eyes. This is a remarkable study that was never done before and made a lot of people very excited that we can actually interpret the brain in real time. Our work was to be presented for the first time to the entire world and show them how you can look at people's brains, decode their thoughts, and show them on the screen.
This has got to be one of the most exciting things you can experience as a scientist. You've worked for years on this project, created this mind-blowing thing, and now you get ready to share your findings with the world.
So typically, whenever we conduct a study, when we are done, we can publish this study in a very prestigious journal. Scientists basically try to publish their work in various journals, and the most prestigious journal is called Nature. That's when you publish your work if you really did something remarkable. Just to give you an example, that's where the discovery of the electron was published. That's where the DNA discovery was published. That's where global warming first, when they realized there's something going wrong, they published it there. So putting your work there really means everyone in the world is going to get to know about it. So our work got published in Nature October 28, 2010. And this was a very important moment when we learned that our work is going to be there, and I was very ecstatic. I knew that somehow everyone in the world is going to know about my work.
Moran Cerf developed a fancy feedback technique that allows him to visualize the firing activity of four more neurons in a patient's head using a movie.
So Nature tries to help you promote your work. So you're going to talk to the news, CNN, MSNBC, BBC, and so on about your work the day of. So everyone would get to know about this thing. And since I wanted to supplement this, I had this great idea. Me and my team are going to film ourselves with a short clip where we explain to everyone what we did.
This is Christoph Koch of Caltech.
So we try to make the most of this incredible rare opportunity by asking the patient to play a simple video game in which they can use their thoughts to control what they see on a computer monitor in front of them.
And this is going to be very kind of clear to everyone, and it's going to be on YouTube. Everyone can see that. And we did this movie, and in the end of the movie, one of my colleagues in the team was speaking to the camera, and I asked him, what do you think the future holds for this type of work? And he said, well, in the future, we could actually interpret people's thoughts, and we can activate machines by just thoughts, and we can even maybe interpret dreams and see how dreams work.
There may be, in the future, an ability to develop brain-machine interfaces which are based on human thought, on human intention, on human imagery, on human memory, or even on human dreams.
Fade out, and the movie ends. The last two words are, we can interpret how dreams work. Just to be clear, we didn't do any of that. The question was, what could be done in the future? We never did it. We never even recorded anything during sleep. But somehow, these last words got a lot of attention.
On human intention, on human imagery, on human memory, or even on human dreams.
The day the work was going to come out, it's going to come out at 6 p.m. England time. That's when they have the first press release. And I was in Los Angeles, and I was working the entire night preparing for this press release, writing all kinds of sketches of what to say. And I went to bed at 6 a.m. to sleep for 4 hours before I wake up at 10 a.m. Los Angeles time, which is 6 p.m. New York time, and actually see how my work kind of gets out there and everyone adores my work. I was very excited. I put my clock, my alarm clock on my phone to 10 a.m. and I put the phone on vibrate so I won't wake up before that. Went to bed. I woke up at 9 a.m. because my phone was vibrating for 10 minutes straight. That's because someone from BBC UK got a hold of the video a little bit before it came out, saw it, and was really interested in the last two words. This is going to be a way to understand how dreams work. And he calls me and he says, I'm the senior executive editor of BBC Nightly News. We have the nightly show at 8 p.m. and we want you to go on live and explain how you can record dreams. And I say, what? So I don't understand. I didn't even remember this last word. And he says, I heard about your work and I know it has to do with dreams and how you can interpret them. And I want you to kind of explain live on the news how you do that. It's going to be the last segment in our nightly news. And we're going to end up with a scientist explaining how you can record and interpret dreams. And I say, wait, that's not what we do. He said, wait, I don't understand. Someone in your team said that you can understand how dreams work. And I tried to make sense of that. I didn't remember that. And I said, someone from my team talked to him, probably someone else said something, it was misinterpreted, but I'm trying to kind of be collegial. And I say, well, he probably meant that we can, in theory, record dreams. And he said, so you can record dreams? Said, in theory. He said, thank you. Hang up the phone. And the last thing is me saying, yes, we can, in theory, do that. And now it's 10 a.m., an hour later. And I see on Google that the news about our work came out. And before I understand what's going on, I see that the first thing on BBC is scientists at Caltech can record dreams. And I say, well, that's crazy how they kind of interpret our work wrongfully, but it's okay, like one guy. Refresh. 10 more news websites. Now it's CNN. MSNBC. They all report about the scientist in Los Angeles who can record and interpret your dreams. And I get really worried and nothing about the real work. No one talks about our real work, which is pretty remarkable. Looking at people's thoughts and showing them, no one actually mentioned that. It's all about the dream recording machine. And at first it was very subtle. It says, scientists say that they can record dreams. 10 minutes later, when other news outlets picked that up and started kind of going on with the story, it was, scientists have been recording dreams for the last decade. A minute later, it was, scientists are recording dreams and keeping them in database. They have all our dreams in database. 20 minutes later, the FBI uses scientists to record everyone's dreams. The CIA uses it to monitor dreams, and so on. The story gets bigger and bigger. There's no mention of my real work. All that you can see on all the reports of all the news, MSNBC, BBC, CNN, all of them talking about the scientists at Caltech who can record your dreams. And some of them have me quoted as explaining how it works. And now the DRM, the dream recording machine, has a name. And people refer to it as such. And they start describing it, the mentions of it. It's like it weighs 20 pounds and they're trying to get a product that's going to be in your home. And they really go on and on. And I really try to kind of answer the phone and explain to each and every person that calls me how it's not true. But after a few minutes, I realize it's futile. No one listens to me. So I talk to my dad, who's a journalist. And I ask him, Dad, how can I kill a story? What's the way? And he says, well, in my experience, the only way to kill a story is to turn off your phone and not answer anyone for 24 hours. It's going to die on its own. No one really cares about science. And I say, okay, in 24 hours, it's going to die. 24 hours later, not only are we number one, but we're also number two, because the story about our dream recording machine is number one, the story about the FBI using it is number two. I still not answer my phone, and I try to tell my friends how upset I am, and hope that it's gonna die within a few minutes or hours, or something's gonna take over that. 24 hours later, still number one, there are some scientists in the world who actually try to record dreams. They've been doing it for years, and they were never able to do that. So they comment on our work, and they say, it's impossible and you don't understand how I did it so silently that no one even knew about my work for so many years and suddenly I come out of the blue. It's impossible that this group came from nowhere and did dream recording what no one else can do. Their rivals, who've been trying to do that but hate them, answer, well, you guys are not good enough, that's why Moran did it before you guys. And scientists go live and they say, well, I've not heard of this work before, but it's very likely that if they have electrodes in their brain, they can actually record dreams. And it goes on and on. And it's on news and it's on the media and people comment on it and there's like talk shows where they use it to kind of imagine how the world would be in 10 years where all the dreams are going to be exposed, and none of that is true. And I start getting emails. I'm not answering my phone, so I get emails from people all over the world who emails me their dreams. They're giving me their dreams, ask me to interpret them and ask me to comment on them and ask me to if I can come and help them because they have like the same nightmare occurring again and again, and maybe I can read their nightmare and understand and prove to their husband that the nightmare is real because the husband doesn't believe them and they wake up every night. And people send me their crazy story and I try to answer every person and explain that it's not true. But after the 50th or 100th email, I just give up. It's unstoppable. I just put all the emails in one folder and I say, at one point I'm going to answer all of them. I get a phone call from this chef, a French chef, who's very famous, and he calls and he says, look, I've been dreaming this recipe for many years now, but I can't remember it when I wake up. Can I volunteer and be your subject and you're going to put electrodes in my brain and look at me when I sleep and find this recipe and give it to me? And I say, sir, we don't have any dream recording machine. It's a mistake. He says, please, I really need it. You've got to help me. And I get a phone call from a very senior guy in a computer company who calls me and he says, I've heard about your work and I want to buy your DRM, your recording machine, for our kind of coming operating system. I want to use it. And I say, I admire your work, but we don't have any of that. It's a mistake. And I explain the story. He says, oh, I understand. You're trying to keep it a secret. So why don't I pay you some money and I'm going to be optioning this thing. So when it actually comes out, we're going to be the first to use your thing as a feature in our system. We can call people dreams. And people offer me money and they want to buy it and there's fights. People really want hope. So they keep asking me to help them report their dreams, analyze their dreams, and the thing doesn't die. But now it's October 31st. It's Halloween. And my friends, they see that I'm upset and they say, come on, just forget about that. Let's go out tonight, dress up, get a costume, and forget about this thing that annoys you for 3 days. Just do something fun with us. And I say, you know what, you're right, it's only work, and it's something that I'm sure that the scientists who care about that will know the truth, so I just have to do something fun and forget about it. And we all go outside and dress up. And I decide as a kind of a self-deprecating joke to dress up as Sigmund Freud, the guy who interprets dreams. So I put a little beard on me and some glasses and a pipe with a little vest, and we all have a night out where I manage to forget about my problem of the last 4 days. And some people take pictures of us, and they put them on Facebook, and on Twitter, and on the website. And 24 hours later, if someone looks for Moran Cerf, the scientist who recorded your dream, not only do they see the story about that, but they see a picture of me looking like Sigmund Freud. So now there's a picture, which is worth a thousand words, of me actually looking like Sigmund Freud interpreting dreams. So the story picks up again. Instead of dying, now it's November 1st, and the story would not die. It gets bigger and bigger, and I don't know what to do. And then my friend tells me, you know what, don't worry about it. In 3 days, they're going to have the midterm elections. And the Congress is going to change hands. It's going to be a Republican Congress now. This is a much bigger story. Surely your story will die when this happens. November 5th, the Congress changes hands. Still story number one. Scientists in California can record your dream. And then also Republican Congress is now taking over in the U.S., Nature calling me and then saying that they're very happy with the sales of the recent edition because it's the biggest edition that they had in this year. Everyone is happy. And I know it's all a lie. Until luckily, 2 days later, the Prince of England announces that he's going to marry his girlfriend of many years. And this suddenly tops every story, becomes story number one, and our story decays gradually. And I feel it's over and everything's going to be okay. People are moving on and I can live happily with that. And I gradually will become a scientist again rather than a press or media person. And then I get a phone call. It's evening in Los Angeles, and the phone rings, and I answer the phone, and there's a person telling me, hi, Mr. Cerf, I'm going to put you with Chris in a second, just hang on. And before I get to know what's going on, I hear a British voice on the phone says, hi, this is Christopher Nolan. As you know, we had the movie Inception out a few months ago, and in a few weeks, the DVD is going to come out, and I'm going to actually go on a tour to kind of release the DVD on Australia. I'm going to promote this DVD. And I heard about your dream recording machine. And, you know, it's very relevant to our sleep movie and your sleep studies. I want you to come with us on tour and be the spokesperson of this project. Talk about your dream recording machine, about the science behind it, and explain how Inception can actually happen in real life. That's going to be great for our sales. I'm going to pay you. I'm going to have you over. And it's going to be your kind of way to promote your work and get it to the general public. And I say, sir, I really love the movie, but I'm sad to tell you that our project has nothing to do with sleep, with dreams, or anything to do with that. We just recorded how people think when they're awake and in a very controlled environment. And he says, send me the paper. I'm going to find something about dreams there. And I take the paper itself, 4 pages of very sophisticated math, and I send it to Christopher Nolan for him to read and understand that there's nothing about dreams there. And he calls me 24 hours later, and he says, I read your work. There really is nothing about dreams there. Nothing about sleep. I understand. It doesn't matter. You can still come with me on this tour. Everyone in the world perceives you as the dream and sleep person. You're the authority now. You can come with me and just claim that this is what was done, explain how it works, just assume this position. You can become the DRM person. And it takes me a few hours before I say no, where I kind of consider, should I be an actor or a scientist? And I choose that I should pursue my career in science and let go of this opportunity to travel in Australia and explain to people how to record dreams and how to better their sleep. And when I say no, he understands and everyone understands. And I very much remember the last words when I told him that I'm not going to do that. He said, you know what? What matters is only how people perceive you. The world perceives you as the dream recording scientist, the guy who can report and analyze their dreams. it means that this is what you are. You're the scientist who records dreams. It doesn't matter that you actually don't do that. What matters is how people see you. So if you just maintain this image, you can do whatever you want.
Moran Cerf is continuing his work on direct recording from human brains, and you may catch him telling his stories at the Moth Storytelling Nights here in Los Angeles. Plus, you can see the video describing his work on our website, kcrw.com/unfictional, and while you're there, you can become a fan of this show on Facebook.
The bats are in the belfry. The dew is on the moor. Where are the arms that held me and pledged to love before? And pledged to love before? And it's such a sad old feeling. All the fields are soft and green. It's memories that I'm stealing, but you're innocent when you dream. When you dream, you're innocent when you dream. When you dream, you're innocent when you dream. I made a golden promise that we would never part. I gave my love a locket, and then I broke her heart. And then I broke her heart. And it's
I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional, a part of KCRW's independent producer project. The editor of the program is Jacob Conrad. Music supervisor is Dan Wilcox. Thanks to the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation for their support of the independent producer project and Unfictional. You can find links to past episodes at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. And while you're there, you can leave a comment. And I invite you to become a fan of the show on Facebook, too, and start a discussion of this very episode, if you like. You can podcast earlier episodes of the show either at the website or at iTunes. And if you like the program, please tell your friends about it. I'm Bob Carlson, and however you listen, I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional on KCRW and KCRW.com.